unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and I won't say boys and girls because they probably run away screaming when they hear the voice of the personal wealth coach in the morning. But good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is a talk radio program where you can call in and ask questions. We're going to discuss things about the economy and investing, finance, money, basically anything that has to do with that green stuff, even if it's not green and in its electronic form. What does it mean? What does the world mean from the economic viewpoint? Sometimes we touch on politics a bit, but we try to only touch on the politics that deals with money. So don't expect us to spend a lot of time dealing with the scandals of the White House, unless it deals with money. So let me give some disclosures. First and foremost, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake McClure. Jeff is out of town. Jeff McClure is off in Colorado, enjoying cool, crisp mornings and beautiful vistas. Well, I'm back here dealing with the Texas heat. Well, we did have some good rain this last week, so it wasn't bad. We are also an SEC registered investment advisory firm under the same name, the Personal Wealth Coach. Now, that's not coincidental. Something I have to tell you very clearly is we don't give investment advice over the air, because that's totally inappropriate. If I gave advice to people, it should be some very, very basic stuff like cover before striking and that sort of thing. Look both ways before you cross the street. Very generalized stuff we give on the air. Specific advice could be taken the wrong way for the wrong person. So if I told somebody to invest in something very specific to them on the air and somebody else heard it, it could be the last place they should be investing. And if you have questions about that, about why that would be, you can call in. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400. I have a lot to talk about today. I was not here last week. We did a rerun. And the week before that, we had a pretty good episode, but a lot has happened in the bit of time since I was here last. So I'm going to hit some of the big points. First, I'm going to talk about what's happened in the market this week. We generally try to start with that. And I had it all set up. I've got two-factor authentication going on here, so I have to put in a code while we speak. But, and just as a side note, people know that I'm into cryptography and security on your computer. If you don't have second-party authentication on your emails, you should sign up. It's not hard, and it's one extra layer between your money and the people that want to take it from you. So please take a moment and set that up. Whatever service you're using, they're going to allow some form of it. So all it is sometimes they'll send a text to your phone when you're trying to put your password in for your email, and you have to put in a special code. It's not the most secure way of doing it, but it's a lot better than just leaving the same password you use for everything else on your emails. Okay, so what happened this week? This week, the S&P 500... continued celebrating higher earnings. We have huge earnings this year. It's fantastic. It's above the 2900 line, the S&P 500. It's Thursday it broke records. Friday was slightly below the record on close. It's at 2901.52. So for the week, it was up almost a full percent. It's 0.93% up. Year to date, that's from January to now, it's up about 8.5%. And the 1 year gain, going back 12 months, it's 17.16% up. That's fantastic. The 10-year U.S. Treasury bobbed around during the week. First it went up because of the Mexico agreement over the NAFTA stuff, and then it bobbled down because it didn't look like Canada was going to be able to get in and sign in time for the deadline, and so it finished the week exactly where it started, at 2.858%. It's still almost a full percent higher as far as the interest rate from a year ago. We are in rising interest rates. Even if it's taking a while to do it, rising interest rates are the reality of the world at the moment. So what's happened with oil? We tend to watch West Texas Intermediate. That's the American benchmark for oil prices. And it was up about 2% for the week, closing at $69.90 a barrel. That's up about 40% from a year ago. Gold was down about 0.5% for the week at $1,206.80 an ounce. It's continuing its long-term slide. It is now down over 9% year-to-date and about 11% for the last 12 months. The dollar index, that's done by the Wall Street Journal, this week was the reverse of gold. It has not been the rule anymore, but this week it did do the reverse of gold. It rose about 0.34% for the week. It's up 4.23% for the year. It's up about 5.3% against the Chinese yuan for the year so far. So why is that important? Because if our dollar is more expensive, it makes it more expensive to buy American goods in the rest of the world, which kind of explains why our trade deficit is up for the second month in a row, massively up. And this is kind of the opposite of what the intention was when starting a trade war. It caused the American currency to get much, much stronger, read more expensive for the rest of the world to buy our goods. And that's caused the gap, the trade gap, to get wider based on the things that the president's been trying to do to narrow the gap. So in trying to narrow the gap, we've widened the gap. We have a greater deficit in trade than we did before the trade war began. Okay, so what else happened this month or this week? This week, the U.S. International Trade Commission unanimously overturned the tariff on Canadian pulp paper. What does that even mean? What is this? One of the tariffs that was imposed by the president, he's imposed a lot of tariffs on a lot of different subjects. There are specific reasons and uses for these tariffs. They're defined in the law. The law says these are the ways you can use them. Well, the president's been using them to negotiate, not for their defined reasons. So the U.S. International Trade Commission, which is appointed by the president, overturned the president's tariffs on pulp paper. We've talked about that here. It's not one of the tariffs that you hear much about when you're listening to the trade wars stuff. It was one of the original tariffs before he went on to go kind of sweeping across the board tariffs to everybody. He targeted Canada's some of their softwood lumber and the pulp paper. What that did is a lot of the small newspapers in the United States have either had to lay off people or close down completely because the price went up so high at a time when paper newspapers are not, their circulation's way down already. And when you raise the price, they couldn't hand that price increase on to their customers, or their customers just canceled it. So it was a lot of the local newspapers have suffered a lot based on this tariff. There may have been a negotiating reason to use the tariff. And, you know, I do carpentry on the side, and I really enjoy it. I hurt myself regularly doing it. It's something that I'm very careful with, but it's this beautiful concept, and I find myself hurting myself in carpentry when I'm using the wrong tool for the job. And these tariffs that were used were very clearly the wrong tool for the negotiating job. They had a defined purpose. When the U.S. International Trade Commission unanimously overturns a tariff, it's a statement. Now, that's been very, very lightly covered. There's been a lot of other big stuff happening. The scandals are covering up big events in the news. So let's drill down into some of the other things that have been happening, and I'll kind of tie this together. Anytime we're talking about trade deals, whether it's between one company and another, between at a swap meet where you're coming to trade with someone, any of the more modern negotiating classes that you take at the collegiate level, like, for instance, if you're going for an MBA, are going to deal with the best forms of negotiation. There's more than one kind of negotiating. If you're never going to see the person again in your life, you're about to do business with them, it doesn't matter how mean you are to them. It doesn't matter how much you try to gouge them. You try to get the best deal you can possibly get out of the thing, even if it leaves them bleeding. But if you want to see them again, if you want to continue to do this kind of trade again in the future, if you expect this to be a regular occurrence, you need to be nice in the deal. You need to both leave the trade winning. That's, you know, this all these self-help books about win-win. Well, that's, you know, on the business level, if you want to stay in business and your customers are buying things from you, you want them to come back, which means you want them to feel like they got a good deal or got good service or some really good thing happened that they were willing to pay for while you continue to make a profit. This is kind of common sense, so most of you understand this already. When it gets to the world trade arena, that somehow we throw it out the window and we think, well, it's us versus them. That's not business. Us versus them is not business. Unless you're a direct competitor, one company that makes a nearly identical part to another company, you may be in direct competition there. That's fine. You generally aren't going to go make a deal with that company, though. You're going to make a deal maybe with the parent company, with one of its other companies as a supplier for one of your goods or whatever. So the concept of business being dog-eat-dog, capitalism being about the one left standing in the bloody scrum, that's not what capitalism is. So let's go back. The word capitalism is based in the word capital. The word capital is Latin for head. It means know-how. It means experience and education. The very most fundamental precept, according to Adam Smith, of capitalism is that people should be benefiting from their own know-how. That's why they called it capitalism. You knew how to do something, you should get paid for it. This is fantastic. You went to school for a long time to do something that everybody wants you to do. You should get paid to do that. You should get paid based on how many other people are trying to do it and how good you are at it. If there's not a lot of people doing it and you're really good at it, you should get paid a lot of money. The other end of the spectrum is socialism. Everybody should be paid the same thing, no matter what their skill level, no matter what their... So you can see how socialism and capitalism are at the opposite ends of a spectrum. We're a capitalistic country, and the capitalism that is endorsed by the president, by the Democrats, by the Republicans, is that if you're good at something, merit-based pay. If you're good at something, you should get paid more for it. You're not going to find even the most socialist of Democrats. Bernie Sanders will not say that a doctor in the United States should get paid the same as a janitor. So you go out to the most extreme socialist in the United States, and we're still pretty capitalistic. So that's just to let you know, there's people on the far end of the capitalistic curve that look at Bernie Sanders as being ultra-communist, and it's just not there. I mean, Cuba was ultra-communist, Soviet Union was ultra-communist, and it didn't last because you can't pay a janitor and a doctor the same pay and expect people to go to medical school. It just doesn't work. And, well, there's a few of them that do. But they're kind of saints. There aren't that many saints in the world. Human nature gets in the way. Okay, so what's happened with this trade? The president ran on the platform of possibly abolishing NAFTA. He never came right out and said, I'm going to do it. He said a lot, I might do it. He said a lot, it's the worst trade deal ever done. So, on Monday, we signed an agreement, a preliminary agreement, with Mexico. Before we get into that, let's talk about the process, because there's a lot of sound bites. This isn't a very good sound bite program. This program, I'm going to try to get down into what makes these things work. What are the connections? NAFTA is a three-part deal. The North American Free Trade Agreement. It was signed under Bill Clinton. It was one of the first ones that first agreements on trade that wasn't a treaty. They tried quite a long time to make a treaty. That takes a supermajority of the Senate on trade. But the Democrats kept blocking it. They didn't like it. They said there's not enough support for unions. This is too good for big business and not good enough for the workers. Ross Perot didn't like it. He said it was this giant sucking sound, this concept of free trade. Well, the end result of NAFTA was better pay for Americans almost across the board and better pay for Canadians and Mexicans almost across the board. So the theory that the Democrats had of this isn't going to work because it's going to be really bad for the workers didn't pass muster. And it was signed by Bill Clinton under a Republican Congress. So it was bipartisan. It was this thing where we looked at it and we said, all right, as a group, we can all agree this is good for business. It's going to work out well. Okay. There's a lot of stuff in NAFTA, and if you look through NAFTA, there's lots of stuff that anyone can point at and say, that was dumb. What is that about? So I'm going to use one example of that to let you see there is a lot of stuff in there. We produce corn in the United States. We're the largest corn producer in the world, and we subsidize it drastically, hugely. Our government pays lots of money for corn from farmers. The Farm Bill is a bipartisan event almost every year. This year was a little bumpy because somebody tried to tack on some other stuff to it. But it's a bipartisan thing. We all agree we need farmers. That subsidy, that's not fair trade. If somebody else is trying to grow corn and wants to sell it to us, when they try to sell it to us, our prices are already way too low for them to competitively come into our market. But we're okay with that because that's one of our areas. Corn is a big lobby in the United States. In Canada, dairy is a big lobby. Well, there's a big lobby for dairy in the United States as well. Why am I talking about dairy? Well, dairy is one of the sticking points, and we'll get to it in a minute. In Canada, they regulate their dairy industry in a way that's very similar to the way we regulate corn. They don't want an oversupply of dairy, but they don't want an undersupply either. They very carefully set the amount of dairy they're producing to be just as much as they need inside Canada, with maybe a little bit extra if they want to trade outside, because they don't want to run short. This is for the same reason that the lobby for corn in the United States is strong. The lobby for dairy is in most of the dairy productions in Quebec, and usually in swing states, swing districts in Quebec. So it's a relatively small part of their population, but it's got a big voice because they're on the margin in swing positions, just like we have in our electorate. So dairy has a bigger voice than normal in Canada, and they don't like the fact that every time there's a new trade deal written, they're the ones that suffer. So I'm going to throw in one other piece to the puzzle here, kind of laying it all out slowly, piece by piece. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the one that our president pulled out of, very definitely, clearly dealt with dairy in Canada. It allowed a lot more U.S. exports to Canada in dairy. Well, when we pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the dairy industry in Canada was happy as can be, because now they were selling, they get to sell their dairy to everybody else in the Trans-Pacific Partnership with almost no competition. So they're starting to ramp up production. While at the same time in the United States, people are drinking less milk. I'm sure you're all aware of this. You walk down, if you go to the grocery store, you will see that a larger and larger percentage of the dairy section is being taken up by non-dairy alternatives. Almond and soy and all these different alternatives to dairy are taking up space in the dairy aisle. That has a direct impact on the dairy sales. We're overproducing dairy at this point. So are the Canadians. So we have an abundance of dairy. People are having to dump dairy in ditches. Say that 10 times fast. This is a thing where people do cry over spilled milk because it's worth millions of dollars. And they have to intentionally spill it because you can't save it. Milk goes bad. So where we are coming forward to this point, we're revising NAFTA. So what happened is you hold on to that dairy stuff. Hold on, that sounds really gross. Hold on to the idea of the dairy that we just talked about. Okay, so coming forward to today, Monday, the United States and Mexico signed a preliminary agreement. Here's the rundown of what it was. Number one, we're agreeing that hourly wages in the construction of automobile parts, so most of this has to do with automobiles, it's a very tiny portion of the original agreement, very tiny. 40% or 45%, it's very vague in there, of the car parts must be made by workers that earn more than $16 an hour. Okay, that looks like, on the surface, a win for the United States. You would think that. The current average hourly worker in a Mexican plant for a U.S. car manufacturer, they get about $2 an hour. So going up to $16 an hour means those parts are likely to get made in the United States. But the reality is that it's much more likely that they'll get automated. Okay, so there's another piece in there, right in there. It's the promise that Mexico will allow labor unions into the plants. That doesn't sound like a very Republican thing to say, but we've just gotten them to agree to that. Okay. Okay, right now, on the contract level, the company dictates the terms, and if the person doesn't want those terms, they've got to negotiate on their own. Now we are allowing the Mexican group in this plant to get together and unionize and have a group negotiation for their wages. Okay? Again, doesn't sound very Republican. This is why the Democrats stopped it from happening before. But okay, all right, that's fine. So that's on the hourly wages. The next piece is that the car itself has to have been 75% made from parts in Canada, America, or Mexico, not from elsewhere in the world, in order to not have a tariff. It's gone from 62.5% to 75%. Again, that's not a very huge shift for the size that NAFTA covers. So these changes, which are relatively small, and there's one other, this is the biggest one. This is the change that, of the things that I've talked about so far, is the biggest one. There's something called a tribunal. And if you've listened to this program in the past, you've heard us talk about the NAFTA tribunal. The chair of the tribunal is always America. And then there's an equal number of Canadians and Mexicans, but the tie-breaking vote is American. If there was a dispute on a tariff, so say Mexico says we're going to put a tariff on corn, that immediately would go through the tribunal process. The American chair, if there was a tie vote, would say we're not doing this, but the Canadians and the Americans would probably say, hey, you can't do that, that's not part of the trade agreement. Well, that's been changed. It's now been set. We forced Mexico now to say it must be dealt with, the tariffs must be dealt with in the court of the country who imposes the tariff. So when we're talking about a tariff imposed by Mexico against, say, well, since we were just covering car manufacturing, against parts made in the United States coming into Mexico into a car manufacturing facility and then coming out as a car into the United States, so back and forth. If they impose a tariff on those car parts, we've got to go to a Mexican court to try to fix it. If we in the United States impose a tariff on Mexico, they've got to come to the courts in the United States to fix it. In my mind, this is a very short-term scenario because we're putting a lot of tariffs on a lot of things right now. Now we've admitted, we've gotten Mexico to admit that all of our tariffs, they've got to go to American courts to try to fight. That's short-sighted. It is good for America at the moment because we're putting a lot of tariffs on, but what if it's Mexico that's putting the tariffs on later? What if they get a lot of good deals with other countries and they're not dependent on us anymore? This could be decades in the future, but it's out there. And then they start imposing tariffs on us. We don't have an agreement that says how we resolve that anymore. So we've got an agreement with Mexico. Those are the things. So we now went from the worst trade deal on record to the biggest trade deal on record. This is from the president. I don't understand why it's the biggest. The president likes to speak in hyperbole. I'm going to be okay with that. That's fine. There aren't enough changes to this to make it anything better than what it was. It's a little bit better. I mean, it was okay before. It's still okay. It's still not great. It's freer trade, except now we've got some of the free trade pulled out. So Monday, we turned to Canada and said, you've got to sign by Friday or the deal's out. Now, why Friday? Well, if you don't sign by Friday, we're going to put tariffs on you. Why Friday? Well, because there was a presidential election in Mexico. And Enrique Peña Nieto, and I know I'm mispronouncing that, is no longer going to be the president. He is still the president, but come December 1st, AMLO. And I'm not going to say his name, his four initials are what he goes by, AMLO. He won a full majority in the election. That hasn't happened since 1988. He takes office on December 1st, and he has said repeatedly he's not going to do anything to NAFTA. He wouldn't sign anything that was put before him. Okay, so December 1st seems like a long ways away. Why did we have a deadline for yesterday, Friday, to sign this deal with Canada? The reason for that is because we have a process. NAFTA exists on the book as a law that was passed by Congress and signed by the president, which means if you make a change to it, it's got to be passed by Congress and signed by the president. And in the law, it says they've got to have a 90-day review process for any changes. The 90-day point from yesterday, August 31st, would have left November 30th, the last day of the current president of Mexico, the day to sign it. So now anything that we do is likely not going to get signed by Mexico. This is one of the problems with when you arbitrarily stop honoring the agreements signed by former presidents. Is that the next president may not honor your agreements. And that's a short-sighted thing. It's very much like ending the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees. It shouldn't be overused. You shouldn't be filibustering everybody. That's a given. But getting rid of the filibuster means that the minority power lost any input. They have lost the ability to say no if they don't have a majority. And that might be okay. And most people that are in the happy position on the Supreme Court right now that are looking at the Supreme Court nominees and saying this is great are happy with the ability for the majority to pass this very easily. You'll be happy if that's you until it's the other side that has the majority. We're doing a deal where we're making the other side bleed, and we've got to go back to the table with them in the near future when they may be the one in majority. Don't expect them to be nice to you if you weren't nice to them first. So this sounds like we're talking politics. Back to dairy, and we've got to play some commercials right after this. I've been going on this subject a long time. Hopefully you're getting something out of this. Back to dairy. The reason why the Canadians didn't sign the deal on Friday is because the deal, which the American dairy groups have a lot more dairy than they can sell at the moment. They want to sell it to Canada. Canada doesn't have a big market for dairy. There's not tariffs on dairy going in, but there are subsidies on Canadian dairy. And American dairy folks thought they had the deal for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It dried up. That went away. Now they want it into NAFTA. And the president is saying, without that, you can't sign. You got to get rid of your subsidies on dairy. But we're not getting rid of our subsidies or the farm bill on our own products. We subsidize our own dairy, and we're telling them to get rid of theirs. They're not going to sign that. And in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when we were taking our dairy into their country or vice versa, it had to be at an equal playing field, and that was part of the agreement. Now it's not. Now we've got subsidies in there, and we're saying you shouldn't. So that's not a good deal for them. Why would they sign that? And they know that they're in a position of power now, and that AMLO comes in, he's not going to sign anything. We're still back at the original NAFTA. Now, the president could, through executive order, shut down NAFTA. But that's really unlikely to happen. If that would have that would impose a recession on the United States. We would have a recession in a very, very short period of time. He's got to know that. So that's what's led up to now. The Canadians are looking at the tribunals and saying, no, we don't want to solve in U.S. courts whether or not you can tariff things that we've just agreed shouldn't be tariffed. No, we don't want to remove subsidies from our milk so that your subsidized milk can come in and outcompete ours. It doesn't make sense. So it isn't a deal between friends anymore. It's a deal between, you know, this American First concept of we are going to run the show and you get what you take. You get the leftovers, basically. That's not going to be good business into the future. It will make them want to do business with as many other people as they can. It's removing their dependence on us. We are very important to them in their economy. We are a huge portion of their exports. But they have finished signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They've just gotten a huge new market open up to them right as we're trying to push them out of ours. They might wind up doing it. Who is it going to hurt? So these big changes in the manufacturing of automobiles, in how much has to be made inside the three country process, all of that. I have to remind you something. If you've listened to this program for very long, you remember it. If you haven't listened before, this isn't something that should be too surprising. For some reason, it is. Mexico doesn't have any car companies. Canada doesn't have any car companies. The car companies that we're talking about manufacturing in Mexico and in Canada are American car companies. American car companies, not Mexican workers, not American workers or Canadian workers. American companies produce all these things together to make a car. They're the United States of America. It's Ford. It's General Motors. They're creating these cars. Sometimes they're putting them together in the United States. Sometimes it's in Canada. Sometimes it's in Mexico. But the profits go to American shareholders. These changes, this at-the-throat negotiation with Canada and with Mexico over manufacturing cars should very likely have been done directly from the president to Ford and General Motors, not to the heads of states of our two closest allies. This is a problem. It's a major problem. What we're really doing is having a spat about how much American companies should make in the United States and how much they should make elsewhere in the world. It's very much like if you have a child in your house that will not obey you. You've said you're going to go in the, and mow our lawn first. You're not going to mow the neighbor's lawn first. Well, the your child, who gets paid a decent wage for mowing the neighbor's lawn, just went over and mowed the neighbor's lawn before yours. You just told him to mow your lawn first. So rather than going and talking to your child, your son or daughter, to say, why did you do that? I just told you to do it over here. You knock on the neighbor's door and you tell the neighbor, if you don't tell that kid not to mow your lawn first, I'm going to stop selling you the pecans from my trees that I've sold you every year. And the neighbor goes, huh? Well, shouldn't you be talking to your son about this? Well, you need to talk to him. I don't want to be the one to talk to him. You talk to him. That's the point that I'm coming to here. This is a complicated set of layers with companies that are much more important than countries as far as what the trade is. If an American company owns the car part, leaving the United States, still owns it when it's in Canada or Mexico, still owns it when it's put together and comes back as a car, and then it's sold and the profits go to American companies, it's not stopped being American at any point. Who builds it is either going to be in the United States, in Canada, or Mexico, or some combination of that. But to point at it and say, Mexico just got a good deal out of this when the vast majority of the profits came to American companies doesn't make any sense. So now I've hit NAFTA and trade and the issues there pretty hard. I'm going to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to call in, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. Now that I have pummeled NAFTA into the ground, I will move to a different subject. Though if you want to call and ask about that, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. There's a couple of other things that have happened in the last several weeks that have been kind of under the radar here anyway. Our news is mostly taken up with minor scandals in the White House, and it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican or independent. You can look at the news and say, all right, minor scandal after minor scandal after minor scandal. Every day there's something new, and each day the news makes it seem like the biggest thing in the world, when the reality is that whether or not one attorney is leaving the Mueller investigation or one attorney is leaving the White House, or it's not that big a deal. People, I mean, it's happened. There have been more people that have left this White House than others. Okay, that's great. It's not the first time someone's left the White House, though. There's an investigation going on against the president. Okay, until there's new news about it, it shouldn't be news every day. So what did we miss in the covering of the scandals at the White House? Well, Iran is taking back the Iranian-owned enriched uranium that it sent to Russia under the nuclear deal that was signed with our former president, Obama. So this concept of nuclear power in Iran, them developing a nuclear weapon, we just ratcheted that up to it's likely to be happening in the next 5 to 6 years they'll have nuclear weapons. Because we've just removed the restrictions on them doing it. They had agreed to restrictions versus the ones that we imposed on them. I didn't like the deal. I thought there were a lot of things about the deal that wasn't great, but it was better than nothing. Very much like many of the other political things. Better than nothing, it's pretty good. If you have nothing, which is what we have now with Iran, we are imposing sanctions on Iran because they're working with nuclear-enriched uranium that has the ability in sometime in the near future to develop a nuclear weapon from it. They're testing ballistic missiles. So at the end of last month, they tested a ballistic missile. This week, they said that the Persian Gulf belongs to them and that they didn't need any outside influence to patrol it, that it belonged to Iran, and the only people that should be going in and out of there are the people that live there. Now, this is where a huge portion of the world's oil comes from. That's a little silly. We're basically ignoring them in the process. But this is where we're back to, because there is a power vacuum. A power vacuum that the former president, Obama, tried to say, all right, we'll do lots of nations together to fill that vacuum instead of the United States doing it alone. The current president said, no, let somebody else do it besides us at all. So pulled out, said anybody that does business with Iran, they get sanctioned by us, including our allies who agreed with us in the former agreement, but now have to unagree with us, even though everybody put their signature on it. Now that the United States pulled out, their deals, big deals that they made with Iran on oil, based on it being okay to do now, they're losing their shirt on it. This comes back to the same issue. If you don't honor previous presidents' agreements, then nobody's going to honor yours. This is one of my favorite quotes in the world. I always go to other people's funerals or they won't go to mine. And man, is that good. That's Yogi Berra. If we don't honor the previous president's signatures, what next president is going to honor yours? And it's a place that being short-sighted will get a lot of things done in a very short period of time, but they can all disappear again in a short period of time. So these decisions that have been made have come up with some very interesting polls, very interesting surveys that have come out. The small businesses, medium businesses, and large businesses in the United States have been surveyed. And the survey is business better or not than it was last year? 83% of business owners and executives say, yes, it's a lot better than it was last year. So that's cool. Only 11% said that it was worse this year than it was last year, and 7% said not sure. So if you add the not sure and the people that say it's worse together, you get 18% versus 83%, there's obviously some rounding in there that's a little off, but 83% of the businesses are saying they're doing better. Where do you see your business in the next year? Is it growing, contracting, or remaining the same? 76% say growing, 11% say contracting, and 13% say about the same. Okay, this is the one that got me. Because I follow this poll, I've looked at it years and years and years in a row. Which political party supports business more? This has been a very traditional answer till now. It's been a very clear majority of people, business people, think that in the past, Republicans. This is the first time I've ever seen it go the other way. Which political party supports business more? This is being asked to business owners and executives of small business, medium business, and large business. 38% say Democrats. 34% say Republicans. 28% says, we don't even know anymore. That's a big deal. I've talked about this, the demographic shift. The parties are switching positions. The Democrats used to be the conservatives, then it became the Republicans being the conservatives and business-oriented. It used to be Democrats were the business-oriented folks. Texas is a business state. The Republicans have taken for granted that that means it's a Republican state, but when Republicans leave the best interest of business, be surprised if business owners don't follow them. That's just common sense. And that's where we are right now. If the new Republican Party buckles down on support for unions, on instituting extra regulations on how to run businesses, this is the same party whose platform is removing regulations, but adding to trade agreements that unions are allowed, holding on to businesses that are failing at the cost of businesses that are not failing, that are growing. That's not good for business. And that's really hard for people to grasp. That's, you know, I've been hitting trade all this hour. We've got a lot of other stuff next hour to talk about. But these items are items that have relatively small impact in the major news media. On the 24-hour news cycle, you might get a small soundbite. But the reality is that the Republican Party has been leaving business and going into something else, workers maybe. But the Democrats haven't been doing any better. So business owners need to take a bit of a stand and say, this is what we need for business. In Texas, you know, you can see on the politics of it, Beto versus Cruz. The race is getting tight. And if you listen to what Beto is talking about, he's talking pro-business stuff. He's not talking the socialist. He's not being your traditional left-wing Democrat. He's coming across and he sounds kind of like a Republican sounded like 10 years ago, if you listen to what he says. And that's surprising, because what that means is that pro-business has shifted parties. We're seeing it in the polls in the way people think about it. It's happened. What does that mean? It may not be permanent. It may be in the next decade, Republicans go back to being low debt, low taxes, pro-business, instead of high debt, low taxes, anti-business. And it's really hard to say anti-business after the tax cut, except that the trade tariffs, the president has now said multiple times that he's aiming at getting enough revenue from the trade tariffs to try to offset the difference in the deficit by the bigger budget and the lower taxes, which means that he's just done a tax cut for businesses and is doing a hidden tax increase for businesses. A hidden tax increase for individuals. That's a problem. And it sounds like I'm being pro-Democrat here. I'm not. The Democrats are just as anti-business as they've ever been. They only look pro-business in comparison at the moment. So business needs to look at this. If you think that the reason why we elected the current president, President Trump, was elected because of his business acumen, we need a business leader to step up and say, these are things that are pro-business. And he may still be that person, but it's very hard to get a clear understanding of what his plans are. He doesn't tell us them. That's anti-business. Business wants to know what's going on. What's the next thing so we can make decisions about what we're planning on doing in the next 2 years, in the next 5 years, or 10 years? Right now, it's very hard to do that. And next hour, we'll be talking about things other than trade. We're about out of time this hour. Next hour, we got lots of good stuff. Most of it is going to be dealing directly with oil, new technologies, China's growth. What do we have to look forward in our own economy? What are the good things that are happening now, and what are the speed bumps that we have ahead? In the meantime, if you would like to talk to the personal wealth coach off the air, we are an SEC registered investment advisory firm. We do fiduciary advice to individuals of high net worth, to foundations and to corporations. We give good advice, I think. If you want to call us and talk to us, we have voicemail on the weekends, real live people during the week, locally at 254-947-1111. And if you want to call us toll-free, it's 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email me directly at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. Until next